Welcome to the Disney Parks Podcast with your hosts, Tony Castelnova from DisneyByTheNumbers.com and Krista Joy from DisneyWays.com. Keep your hands, arms, feet, and legs inside the podcast at all times and get ready for the Disney Parks Podcast.
Hi, this is Mike Purcell. Welcome to a voyage of discovery and awareness of the richness, diversity, and often surprising nature of living with the land. Our journey begins as dramatic and sudden changes are sweeping over the land. The approaching storm may seem violent and destructive to us, but it's actually just Tony and Krista. You're listening to the Disney Parks Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. Are you ready to embark on a mind-expanding journey into the Imagineering thought process? Today, we are so pleased to welcome the author of a great book called Every Guest is a Hero. Now, this book will take you on a grand tour of the Disney theme parks, revealing for the first time how the Disney Imagineers use their mastery of mythic storytelling to press emotional buttons you didn't even know you had. We even have a free copy of Every Guest is a Hero to give away at the end of the show, so stay tuned for details on that. Adam Berger, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to be here.
We're glad to have you, Adam, because we had met at one of the Disney Parks meetup, and you came and you showed us your book, and we got excited, and Krista said, let's have Adam on the show, so here we are.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be there, Okay. Here, wherever we are, in cyberspace.
In cyberspace.
I'm inside my machine.
I hate it when that happens. No, I love it when that happens, actually. It's my favorite part of the day.
Right. So at the meetup that we had, Adam, you were telling us, not in great details because you weren't allowed to, but some of the things that you've done with Disney, for Disney, with the Disney company, for another company that was hired by Disney. So can you tell us, some of your background and some things about your career and how they relate to Disney?
Well, sure. Actually, I got my start with Disney many, many years ago as a frontline host, working in the parks with the guests. I was a steam train conductor back in the late 1980s. I was one of the last live spielers. This was just as they were converting over to the recorded spiel. So that was very much an interesting introduction for me to the life of a frontline cast member, and it was very instructive for my later life as a show writer and as an attraction designer, because it allowed me to be able to look at the parks and look at attraction design from the point of view of the operator, and to understand how the way that attraction host responds to what you write, needs to be taken into consideration. You can't give a long spiel to just, most typical cast members to repeat every 25 seconds. So, there's all sorts of things that you become aware of when you actually have to do the job for hours and hours a day. And that those kind of insights turned out to be very useful. And I later went on to become a monorail operator. I was one of the last people to drive a Mark IV and among the first generation of Mark VI drivers. So that was an interesting experience. And then from there, I went on to sort of branch out. I left Disney, became a attraction designer, attraction show writer. And among my clients, I've been able to claim projects for everyone from SeaWorld and Universal to Walt Disney Imagineering. So it's been quite an adventure over the years, and it's just been kind of me following the I guess what the mythologist Joseph Campbell would refer to as following your bliss. So it's really been my life endeavor, and I feel very lucky to be able to have pursued it and to have fulfilled it.
So if I heard you correctly, you said a traction designer.
Yes.
So can you tell us about anything you might have done that you're allowed to say?
Okay. Yeah, sure. Well, what I can tell you is that I have... Now, are you talking about Disney specifically or just overall?
Overall.
Oh, sure. Well, if you've ever ridden on any Ride the Ducks tours in Philadelphia or Branson or Stone Mountain, Georgia or San Francisco, I've been the one writing the scripts for them over the years. So that's something you can experience today if you happen to be in any of those cities. I've done a lot of work for Hershend, the people behind Dollywood and Silver Dollar City. So I've written a number of attractions for them. One that's gotten a lot of publicity is their version of a mine train ride, which is Mystery Mine. So that was one that I worked on. I need to say right away that a lot of the stuff I work on is not done just by me. This is a very collaborative business, and very often when I work on a project, it's done with other designers, other writers, other show people. Very often as a subcontractor rather than being as a direct contractor. So there are usually a number of other creative people involved in the process, and very, very few of us can claim exclusive credit for anything like this. So those are a couple of cases. I do a lot of work for behind-the-scenes stuff for Disney, for Walt Disney Imagineering. So you may never get to see a show information guide, but these are the... These are the manuals that the cast members and the Imagineers themselves use as reference material when looking back on the attractions that have just opened or may have opened years and years ago, to remember what was done, to understand the story, the storytelling process that went into them, and to be able to look toward the future if any changes are going to be made over the years in the years to come.
Wow.
That's, you know, it's very fascinating that I guess for me, as you know, somebody that goes to the theme parks quite often, and you know, we've not really directly spoken to a lot of Imagineers, but some of the few that I have. So it's interesting that they go to an outside source to kind of write some of the script stuff or the background story for some of the attractions. Is that?
That is actually very typical within the attraction design industry. I think more so today than maybe in decades past. Walt Disney himself set the mark when he created WED Enterprises, which is the predecessor of WDI. WED, of course, stood for Walter Elias Disney, and he took the whole thing very personally. So this was his own in-house creative team. He sort of set it up in secret with his own money outside the studio. He sort of pulled out the best and brightest artists from his studio staff, from his animators and writers and so forth, and staffed it up. And that was a completely in-house operation. But today, attractions are so big and so diverse that the staffing levels are so changeable that it would really be impractical for any design company to keep a complete show staff on the payroll 12 months a year, all year after year after year. Projects wane and ebb, they come and go. And when you don't have a lot of projects going on at the same time, you really don't have a need for that staff. So what happens is a lot of that staff gets laid off. Some of them become freelancers. Some of them become contractors like me. A number of them go off and start their own companies and begin hiring other former Imagineers or cast offs from other companies. So it's a very small world that we operate on within the design industry, but we and the people who work here, they tend to jump back and forth. I think you may have heard that Jason Sorrell, one of the more well-known show writers for Disney, he's now working for Universal as of a few weeks ago.
Wow.
Yeah, so that is one example of something that happens pretty often. Most of the designers at Universal today, Universal Creative, at one time or another were Disney Imagineers. And there are a number of Disney Imagineers now who and people in the other creative areas at Disney who were former Universal people. It just flows back and forth all the time.
Yeah. So is it more intriguing to work outside of, say, the attractions like Universal, Disney, SeaWorld, or is it more interesting to work actually for that company as a, you know, an attraction designer?
Well, that's an excellent question, Tony. And I would, I can't answer for everybody, but for me, it doesn't really matter what I'm doing or who I'm doing it for. I got into this business because I love to be surrounded by creative people. I always feel that everyone else in the room is more creative than I am. But when I'm with them, I feel like I'm being pulled up to their level. And I just begin to feel that creative energy flowing. So as long as I can be around other creative people, it doesn't matter what sort of arrangement it is. It's always an ad hoc arrangement anyway. There's always going to be a mix of people from all sorts of different disciplines and different backgrounds. But in my case, it doesn't matter what that organization looks like, as long as I'm doing something creative and it's a fun project and I'm just working with all these very talented people.
Yeah, because I mean, I work in a technology industry, and sometimes it's easier to work for the beast than it is to be out on your own trying to, you know, work with the beast.
So. Well, there is a certain level of separation that I get to enjoy from the day-to-day operations. I have worked full-time for a design firm in the past. For almost 5 years, I was working for a company called iTech Entertainment Company. iTech Entertainment Corporation. They've done a lot of fantastic projects all over the world, and they're doing lots of projects now. But for 5 years, I was their senior show writer, and it was an exciting time to be there, but it was also very different from my time as a freelancer. I think I appreciate the variety of having a lot of different clients and just the different people I get to work with and the different types of projects that may be going on at any given moment. So I really do enjoy the life of the design contractor. Not to say I wouldn't go back to being a full-time person again if it was a fun opportunity, but I think there's a lot to be said for the life of a contractor when you have a lot of variety happening around you.
Yeah. So, all right. So I'm thinking to myself, all right, you're an attraction designer. You get hired to build this new attraction for XYZ theme park. Mm-hmm. And it's similar to something you've maybe done at one of the other theme parks you've already done. I am sure it's very hard to separate, well, we've never done this before, or you know, maybe we can reuse some of this over here. How do you keep those two silos from, hey, I can't use this, to, hey, if I change it up enough, nobody will really notice?
Well, yeah, you know, there do seem to be certain trends that occur. You know, a bunch of people will be doing water parks at the same time, or a bunch of people will be doing, you know, cartoon theme parks at the same time, or Viking theme parks at the same time. But it's always been the case that, you know, even when the projects are similar and theme-wise, everybody has a different direction they want to take. There have been one or two occasions when I had to make full disclosure. I had to say, oh, you know, I've already done, I've been working on another project with this a similar theme, and they say, oh, we don't care, it's, you know, we're not involved in the same project and it doesn't matter to us. And I'll check back with the original client and they say, it doesn't bother us as long as it's not the same project. So there would be a conflict. Yeah, there would be a conflict of interest, I think, if let's say there was two RFPs or two requests for proposals that two competing design companies were going after at the same time, and they each wanted to hire me to work on it. But that's only happened once, and one of those companies was involved in the second phase of a project that the first company I had worked for got washed out of. So they didn't mind me going into the second phase.
Yeah.
I have to reiterate that this is a very small industry here. Everybody knows everybody, and for the most part, they're on quite friendly terms with each other because they know they're going to be working for each other later on at some point. They may be collaborating or the staff may be switching over. So everybody does try to stay on good terms. This is not like the movie industry in Hollywood at all. I used to be out there for a while, and you don't get anything like the backstabbing and recriminations and rivalries there. This is a much more collegial, convivial group of people, maybe because it's a smaller community. But in the themed attraction and entertainment design industry, people really get along, and they and there's a level of respect and community that is very refreshing, and it really does go a long way toward encouraging creativity and participation.
Yeah, that's good to hear. It's good to hear.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I can tell you other positive things about the industry if you want to hear them. I should be on their payroll. I'm not. Sorry, go ahead.
No, please go ahead.
Well, one thing I like to tell people is that when I work closely with the Imagineers, I am always struck by the complete absence of cynicism that I see there. And one of the things that really hits me between the eyes is just how much the full-time Imagineers love Disney. I mean, you sometimes hear, you read in the blogs and you hear read comments on and then people complaining that, oh, Disney doesn't care about their own history, or they're just in it for the money. But when you get down to the individual designers and the teams, they are just as big a Disney geek as you and I are. They just are crazy about Disney. They know all the history. They know all the characters and the movies. They can quote lines back and forth. They are crazy about the attractions and the old ones. They miss the old ones, the dismantled ones, and as much as you and I do. They are just the world's biggest Disney fans and Disney theme park fans. You'll never meet people who are more committed to Disney than they are. And nobody's paying me to say this. This is just my pure observation. So, if something doesn't make it in there that you sort of miss and you wish that they had, had a bigger commitment, it's not the designer's fault. It's not the Imagineers. They want it in there. They just, somebody above them maybe, they couldn't be supported by the budget or the time frame or something, but they're just as disappointed as you and I are if it doesn't live up to the standards.
That's so nice to hear. Really, I mean, that's great. And we recently had Jeffrey Epstein on the show, who is I guess in charge of D23. And I mean, you can tell he's a real fan too, like deep down in his soul. And that just, to me, that just makes me very happy, because that these are like-minded individuals that care about your park as much as you do. And, it just means a lot. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. He's more, example of he's a standard. He's not the exception. He is very much in the mold of all the designers that I've met.
Very good. Well, can you tell us a little more about why your book, Every Guest is a Hero, why is this destined to become a cherished addition to every Disney fan's personal library?
Okay. Well, let me give you the full title of the book, first of all. I so hope you're right about that. The full title of the book is Every Guest is a Hero, Disney's Theme Parks and the Magic of Mythic Storytelling. And as you sort of got across a little bit in your introduction, it's really about looking under the hood and understanding the psychological processes that are going on all around you in the theme parks, hidden in plain sight, as I say. So one of the things I like to say in describing it is that when you're in the Disney parks, you're literally surrounded by all these stories, hundreds and hundreds of different stories, at least it seems like hundreds of stories, but when you begin to look a little closer, it turns out they're all really just a single story expressed in all sorts of different variations through many different formats and mediums and rides and in architecture and in shows and in every way that you can possibly imagine, in the shops and the restaurants and in the public areas even in the resort hotels. And that's where my book comes in, because Every Guest is a Hero reveals this what turns out to be a very ancient story that's hidden in plain sight everywhere you go in the parks. And that story is called The Mythic Hero's Journey. Now, as it turns out, this is the very first book ever to delve into the subject of Disney storytelling from this perspective. And I guess what makes it unique is that I'm dealing with some of Walt Disney Imagineering's best-kept storytelling secrets. And it is really the very first time that anybody has delved into any of this in the form of a book or anything. I became involved, very interested in mythic storytelling years and years ago when I was in college. I learned that George Lucas, when he was writing the first Star Wars movie, was heavily influenced by the works of a fellow named Joseph Campbell, a mythologist. And he used Joseph Campbell's theory of the hero's journey in designing his park, creating the first Star Wars movie. And when I found out about this, I tried to learn all I could about it. And the more I learned, the more I realized this not only applies to storytelling into movies, but also to storytelling in the theme park. So I tried to find out more about it. Nobody had ever talked about it. Nobody had ever written about it. And I figured if I was ever going to read a book about it, I'd have to be the one to write it. So that's what I did.
So how does the process of creating an attraction or the script or show writer, how do you start that process, Adam?
Well, inevitably it begins with the client bringing me in and giving me a premise. Usually there's an ad hoc team that's been assembled of all sorts of designers. Sometimes they're in-house. And you are given an overview of what the client wants to achieve. They'll tell you, you know, sort of what the theme is. You know, this is going to be, it's going to be a ride all about musical robots, for instance.
And right.
Now or maybe it's going to be, you know, we're going to turn the children's game Candyland into an attraction. I'm making all these up, by the way. I'm just using made up examples. And now you got to say, okay, now how do we tell that story? They may have technical considerations. They may have to. They may have a specific footprint for the building. You may only have so many square feet to work within. You may have a very low budget, only a few million dollars, or even less than that to work in. You may have a very compressed design schedule. Maybe only a few weeks for the first design cycle. So all these things have to be taken into consideration. And this is where you have to put on your technical hat as a designer, because you have to be able to talk with the other creative people and the other technical people and get a sense of what the limitations are. But you try to go in with as much of an open mind as possible. There are three stages in the design of any attraction, if it goes all the way through to opening. The first stage is the concept stage, where basically you outline the major beats of the story and what the story is about overall. Then you go into design development, or DD, and that is where you really map out the story in great detail. And then, of course, the third stage is production, where you actually begin to assemble it and write the final scripts and all the show signage and all the specific things that you need to actually build the attraction, and then you start building it. So, and then the only other stage after that is cutting the ribbon, and then you shake it out and soft openings and make sure everything works and everything is going to be safe and reliable.
I think I know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Right.
All right. So you have a choice of been told, hey, we have this attraction. It's, let's say, like Jungle Cruise, mm-hmm. where somebody is on stage reading or not reading, has some script memorized in their head.
Sure, reciting a spiel.
Or something like, say, the Haunted Mansion, where it's kind of a dune buggy and the script is kind of, built into the attraction itself. Which one is harder to develop, that live thing or that, pre-recorded over and over, over again kind of attraction?
I think there are different considerations that you have to think about. I've written both kinds, and when you're writing a recorded spiel, something that's going to be the same every time, you can take that into consideration. You know, you have to develop a character. You really, you know, even if it's just a disembodied narrator, you know, you still have to develop a character. So you can do that, and you pretty much have almost complete control over the way it's going to sound. If you have a live spiel going on, even if the cast member who's spieling is required to recite it word for word, they're always going to inject their own personality into it. And you have to consider that when you're writing. You have to make sure that, you know, let me point out that the typical host may not have much of a presentation or performance background. So, there are a lot of Jungle Cruise narrators, Jungle Cruise skippers out there who are very, very accomplished, but you want to make sure that you give them a spiel that they can actually pronounce, that's not going to have a lot of tongue twisters in it, that is going to be something that will be fun to recite over and over again, that won't get too boring too soon, too quickly. Give them something that they can enjoy saying over and over again. That kind of consideration is not necessary when you're doing recorded, but you really do have to think of the live host when you're doing a live host spiel, even Absolutely. If it's something very short.
So it's interesting you say that, because there are Jungle Cruise skippers that are very entertaining, and others that are, it seems like, well, they might as well have just recorded this, because that's what I feel like.
Yeah, I think it's to come to their defense right. A little bit. I would say that having spieled myself over and over again on the steam trains many years ago, you know, I know that if it's your first or second or tenth spiel of the morning, you're probably still pretty fresh. But by the afternoon and your voice is giving out, after you've spieled about 27 or 30 times, you might not sound as enthusiastic or excited, or maybe you found out that you're not going to be able to make your next car payment. It's hard to summon that show must go on mentality.
Yeah, that's true.
But I know that when I always try to put some character into it, though, and I always tried to. I always knew that I wanted to leave an audience entertained whenever I was spieling on the steam train. So, I would even do the voice. I was in my 20s at the time, and. But I'm doing the old conductor voice. Now, as you leave Frontierland Station, if you look to your right, you'll see the rivers of America. On the far side of the river is the inspiring haunted mansion and the spooky Hall of Residence. I get the people in the back in the last car turning around, looking around, like, "Wait, who said that? That couldn't have come out of that skinny kid over here."
You make a point that I've been saying for years now. I remember my first time, 1976, going to the park. Everything was live, unrecorded. The bus drivers, the tram, the train. Everything had a live person. And that was the engaging entertainment from the time you got out of your car to the time you got back in your car. You were completely entertained by some live action thing. Even the characters used to just pop up out of nowhere.
Oh, sure.
And I think that whole spontaneity, that whole entertainment aspect of Walt Disney World, Disneyland, it's starting to lose its luster, its little shine, because everything is now recorded for cost savings, rather than paying.
I would add to that. I mean, you're right. There's a cost savings element to it. But I think that's a very high standard to maintain. I'm not coming to the defense, but I'm just sort of trying to explain that, I think the other consideration is also one of consistency. I think the theory that they're working under at Disney and a lot of other parks, let's be honest, is that that it's better to have something that's less spontaneous but more consistently high quality than it would be to sort of have the crapshoot of a of some guests getting the highest quality live experience and others getting a diminished experience when everything's not really working, when the host is not really up at to the standard.
Yeah,
maybe they're just having a bad day.
I think that's what added to the fun. or the entertainment value. You don't know if you were going to get the funny bus driver or the quiet bus driver. You don't know if you were going to get the funny tram operator or the quiet tram operator. You know,
it was, I'll tell you, yeah, that is very true. I remember once, just after Epcot opened, I was riding on the Friendships. My family members and I, we were the only ones on that boat at that time. It was kind of late in the evening. We were one of the last Friendships going back from World Showcase to World Showcase Plaza. And the host decided to yuck it up just for our sake. And he said, he did this deadpan voice, almost sounded like Stephen Wright, if you remember him, the comedian. And he was saying things like, coming up on our right, we can see China, where you will find many Chinese things. We are now about to crash into Mexico. And we were falling out of our seats.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's funny.
I mean, I could never recreate the way he was saying it, but you know, he knew that we were the only ones on board and right. decided that he would give us a personal show.
Yeah.
And I, you know, this was, when did Epcot open? That was 1983 when I was there. So I still remember it, 31 years later?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes an impression. Absolutely.
Yeah. I'll get off that subject because it drives me crazy. I mean, I could talk about that for hours, but anyway. So back to your book, you know, some of the stuff that I guess is, so what's the idea of the mythic storytelling? What's that all about?
Okay. Well, that's another great question. And let me just make sure I frame it right. It was Joseph Campbell, who I mentioned a few minutes ago in connection with George Lucas. He's the one who coined the term the hero's journey. Now, he was a noted mythologist, an author, and a lecturer, and he spent a lot of years during his career studying and comparing the myths, legends, folk stories, and fairy tales of cultures all over the world. And eventually, Campbell came to this realization that all these different stories had certain elements in common. From these observations, he was able to describe a structure, or what he called a paradigm, that seemed to recur over and over again, and that's what he called the hero's journey. It's also known as the heroic round because the hero's journey is cyclical. It usually begins with the hero in the ordinary world, and then after a series of adventures in the special world, the hero ends up in the ordinary world again. It's also known as the monomyth because it's shared in one form or another by people everywhere. I mean, just think about this. You know, you have cultures, you know, on tiny islands way out in the Pacific, and other cultures, you know, in Asia and in the Alaskan wilderness and in North America and Europe, and they're all telling the same stories with the same characters or archetypes. You know, how is this possible? Well, it turns out that this particular story, the hero's journey, emerges out of the human psyche. It's not something that affects our storytelling. It's something that we affect by, you know, it comes out of our dreams, out of our unconscious, and it basically is a metaphor for expressing all the stages of life that we go through as human beings. So as you can imagine, this is a very, very powerful story because it resonates in the subconscious. That's where it comes from. And when you read it back to the subconscious responds to it. You'll find it in stories that have been, you know, going back thousands and thousands of years. And people have been using it unconsciously all this time just by listening to their subconscious or listening to their dreams, not filtering them, not censoring themselves. It comes out in art. It comes out in movies. It comes out in plays. It comes out in music. And it comes out in theme park designs. So the thing is, it is such a subtle thing that something that we're so accustomed to seeing all around us, we don't even know when we're watching it. Unless you're attuned to it, you may be completely unconscious that it's happening all around you all the time. And once you are attuned to it, though, it's just like seeing, in my case, the theme parks in a whole new light. You begin to realize that there's a whole dimension to the theme parks that just you were not aware of and you were not appreciating before, but now things make sense on a whole different level. You begin to understand why some things are organized the way they are and why certain characters keep cropping up again and again. And why
I love that.
Yeah. It really is a whole different way of looking at the parks, and it's sort of like I almost think of it like the movie The Matrix, where you know there's a sort of this illusion of life that everybody's accustomed to, but you know it's possible if you're trained enough to be able to lift up the veil and look underneath and see all this machinery happening within, and that's really what understanding the hero's journey does. And I try to introduce the hero's journey in a very kind of accessible way. I do it through movies, through relating it to scenes in familiar Disney movies that everyone's seen. And then I take you on a tour of the theme parks and take you through all these different attractions. There's actually 10 case studies of the different theme parks, and I take you through each one scene by scene, through the Haunted Mansion, through newer attractions like Mission Space and Test Track and Radiator Springs Racers, and just guide you step by step through the attractions and how this hero's journey is expressed through them. So
that's awesome. I'm just so excited that you wrote this book, because now people can actually see things in this whole new way, which is always fun. You know, we all think we're Disney experts, and then, you know, we learn something new and we're able to look at things in a new light. That's always cool. So thank you so much for writing the book. That's great.
I hope people will get a hold of it and enjoy it. And I'm glad you're perceiving it that way, because that's exactly how I meant it to be received.
Good. Yeah, absolutely. Well, speaking of which, we need to give away this wonderful copy of the book that you signed for us. Tony, can you tell our listeners how they're going to be able to win this awesome book?
Sure. We want you to go to the podcast page for this podcast that you're listening to right now. So go to Disney Parks Podcast. Up at the top, you'll see podcasts. You'll find this podcast in our directory. We want you to go there, and then you'll see the little orange button where you're going to leave us a voicemail with your favorite attraction. Disneyland, Disneyland Paris, Walt Disney World, Hong Kong, Tokyo City, whatever park it is, whatever attraction it is, let us know your favorite attraction. Don't forget to leave us your email, and then at random, we will pick one of those people and send you Adam's great book for your reading pleasure.
Oh, you're going to make them choose one favorite attraction?
Like one.
One favorite child.
One.
I was going to say, too, it's okay if you haven't enjoyed the attraction yet. If it's something you're dreaming of seeing someday, maybe something, you know, far away that you haven't been able to do yet, you can say that too. It doesn't have to be one you already.
And then we'll play some of those responses back on some future episode, and then tell everybody who the winner of the book is as well.
Yay.
But I do have one other question, Adam.
Oh, by all means.
Before we leave, you know, one of the things that I've noticed in these later years now, since 1976, my first visit, is that the parks are, I guess I'm going to say, crowded. Or there's more guests than there was back in the 70s and 80s. Do you think it's harder to tell the story when people are crammed in these tighter spaces? You know, like Main Street on a busy night, it's hard to feel that sense of Main Street with so many people in it.
Well, the story really depends on all the elements that are involved. And we're not just talking about, you know, words and pictures. We're also talking about settings and environments. The story is conveyed in part, you know, through the entire park, through lighting, through architecture, through the costumes, through through the music, through all the different aspects of your guest experience as you're making your way from one end of the park to the other. Even if you don't go into any attractions, you're still getting a sense of the story unfolding around you if you know what to look for. And I think any kind of element that interferes with that story, it's going to diminish your appreciation and your enjoyment of it. One of the things that's very funny to me is that as designers, we try to create a sense of what we call immersion, that is being totally wrapped up in the story, getting a sense that the story is not a story, but is really happening around you. And Disney is very, very successful at that. But we're always conscious that, you know, there's one element that's going to spoil the story, that sense of immersion, regardless of how intricate and detailed you make it. and that is the presence of the guests themselves. You know, if you say you're setting a scene in sometime in the mid 19th century, and you make everything look sort of early Victorian, and you're making it, you know, you're going to all this detail, and then somebody walks in and they're holding an iPhone and wearing modern clothes and a Mickey Mouse hat, you know.
Yeah.
You know, that's going to impede on the immersion factor.
Yeah.
So you're never going to have 100% immersion unless you keep the guests out or dress them up in period costume.
Well, maybe they should let guests in one at a time.
You know,
just an idea, Disney.
We're not too far away from that. You know, that's sort of what's going on a little bit at Disney Quest already. Maybe not one at a time, but maybe four or five at a time. So, you know, you're not too far off there. But to complete the answer to your question, I think if anything that prevents you from fully appreciating the show in all its in all its details is going to be a diminishment. You know, I was writing on Carousel of Progress a couple of weekends ago, and I became conscious that the sound levels were not distributed properly. One of the speakers was starting to go on the fritz, and this is going to happen. This is a very complex show, even though it's been in operation for many years. But one of the speakers was on the fritz, and you couldn't hear all the characters speaking at the same voice level. And then one of the turntables was rumbling as it turned around, and I became very conscious of that. I don't know if the average tourist would, but I was certainly conscious of it. And I thought, you know, this is the show. I just got taken out of the show for a few seconds.
Yeah. So yeah, I've been on there. Two different things were happening. One was the DJ was over at Stitch thing doing his thing, and you could hear this boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
And
that's exactly the kind of intrusion I'm
trying to and guess. I was like, I don't think Walt envisioned Macarena being played when he was doing this. The other problem I had, it was a different time from that, was in one of the scenes, the father's head was kind of slumped over, like he ran out of like hydraulic fluid to keep his head up.
Yeah,
or he was drinking too much the night before.
I can pretty much guarantee that, you know, if you went on a couple of days later, he would have been fixed.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
as for the music intrusion from outside, that's more of an issue that I think is operational,
rather
than maintenance. Yeah. Oriented, but that to me, in my mind, that's not very different from a guest, you know, using a flash camera during a ride.
Yeah.
You know, even for a fraction of a second, you're taken out of that immersion, and but the crowds, they do the same thing.
Yeah,
so, this is why I like to go at the very, very early hours of the morning. You know, just very soon after park opening, it's a very different atmosphere then, and you can just have a much more enjoyable time with fewer crowds and just really appreciate the setting. You don't get the beautiful lighting of nighttime, of course, but you know, there are lots of benefits to going when it's less crowded. So if you can swing it, that's what I recommend.
Yeah. Well, Adam, I have to say thank you for coming on. We are going to have to have you come on again, and maybe we'll pick like an attraction or two, and then you can debrief us on the whole, you know.
Yeah.
Story of it.
Oh, don't let me get away without telling your listeners where to buy my book.
Yes, please.
Yeah, I'm glad I thought of that. Let's see. It is not available in brick and mortar stores, as far as I'm aware, but you can buy it very easily on Amazon.com, both in print and an e-reader format for the Kindle. But if you have a Nook. The Barnes & Noble device at home. You can go to the Barnes & Noble website. You can buy a print version there or the Nook version there. If you have an iPad, you can download a version of the book for iPad from the iTunes store and the iBook store on iTunes. So, you know, whatever your favorite format is, even the Kindle e-reader version, you know, it'll work on different smartphones. So you have all sorts of options, and I'm a little biased, I think, but I think it's well worth the investment if you really want to enjoy. If you're not lucky enough to win the giveaway copy today,
and we'll link to all that stuff in the show notes this week. You don't have to write it all down and remember it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Well, I appreciate it. And it's been a great pleasure, and I'd love to come back.
And we'd love to have you.
Well, yes, great questions. So thank you very, very, very much.
The Disney Parks Podcast is not affiliated with the Walt Disney